Hello, Michael. How's it going? How are you?
Howdy. I'm doing okay. How about you?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. We'll get into how I am in a bit. I'm going through some pretty interesting times right now. But yeah, it's been I think a pretty shitty day for most people in America. And my opinion is that your country is just fucking broken. But we'll get into that in a second. By the way, before we begin, how's my sound right now? You sound like you're in the middle of the Indy 500.
Oh, do I? Okay, let me close my window.
Good.
You sound fine.
Okay. I was hoping that I'm enjoying the outdoors with my dog right now, and I really don't feel like going back inside. So I was hoping that it's not too windy out here.
Yeah, at a certain point, I just gave up and accepted that I'm always going to be inundated with ambient noise from my apartment overlooking a thoroughfare. But,
I used to actually live like in downtown Toronto, right over the Gardiner Expressway, which was like the major sort of like downtown highway thoroughfare. And yeah, at about 2:45 every single morning, without fail, there would be this loud ass group of motorcycles that rode on by. And it was annoying at first, but then after a while, I was just like, eh, you know what? It is what it is. Nothing you can do.
Yeah, the most sadistic noise is the nightly barrage of ice cream truck songs.
Yeah.
It's funny, when I lived for a little bit in LA, and every day at one point for like 2 hours or 3 hours maybe in the mid to late afternoon, the same ice cream truck would play the same song on loop over and over again, like right in front of the house, to the point that I briefly contemplated becoming one of those guys who does like deep research on zoning laws to figure out if there was a way I could somehow,
Forbid all ice cream
yeah,
trucks in
get
the neighborhood,
that ice cream truck out of there. But eventually I gave up.
Well, sorry I had to go through all that.
It's okay. I survived.
Thanks again for filling in for Glenn. We have this saying in Jamaica, and it goes, "You see how show off brings shame," meaning that when you boast, like when you make a big show of yourself, the problem is karma will come back and bite you in the ass. And so last week, Glenn was talking about his like vitality and fortuitousness, in that he didn't actually get COVID, so he was able to overcome the sickness. And lo and behold,
Wait, he didn't? I thought he did have COVID. It turned out he never got it.
apparently he didn't have it. Apparently, he was just a little, he was sick, and now he has no voice. So,
Yeah. It's he's been cursed by Samuel Alito.
so yeah, I mean, obviously, what we're going to talk about today has to do with the Supreme Court ruling. I do want to spend more time with callers than we normally would. Like, we have our
Yeah.
own, comments to make about it, but I would like to hear what the audience hears about it. So if you're somebody who normally calls in and, sometimes you find your
Q, unless it's just me, I think you might have dropped out. Let's
Hello, can you,
see.
sorry,
Yeah,
that
you're
was kind of
back.
strange. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're back now.
Okay, yeah, sorry, the app just crashed momentarily. But I was going to say, like, if you're normally the kind of person that finds yourself like, eighth or ninth in the queue, feel free to hop on in because we want to hear more from you than hear ourselves speaking today.
Yeah, and I think that works for sort of a real-time breaking story like this that I don't think you or I have especially deep expertise in. I mean,
Sorry, I'm not a constitutional lawyer. Yeah.
I mean, I'm conversant in the relevant issues on different levels, but I'm not going to claim that I spent years deeply embedded in Roe versus Wade case law.
No, but I think it is worthwhile talking about the political dimensions of this because the first thing that happens, first, Susan Sarandon is trending on Twitter for a reason, and that's because everyone seems to believe that Susan Sarandon and the Bernie Bros are responsible for this outcome. That's the part that I'm interested in. Is essentially Democrats have used the issue of women's right to abortion as a fundraising tool from campaign to campaign over the last 50 years, approximately. And sorry, I would say, actually, no, that's not true. Closer to 40 years. But they've been using it as a campaign tool in perpetuity. And when they had the opportunity to pass a law that enshrines a woman's right to choose by codifying it, unfortunately, Barack Obama's supermajority government chose not to pursue that avenue. And many people said that, well, he had to separate his agenda so that he could get the Affordable Care Act passed, to which I would then ask, well, is abortion care not healthcare? Is a woman's right to choose not part and parcel with healthcare? And when people begin to understand that part of the reason that Democrats did not pursue it as part of the healthcare package was because they were under heavy pressure by Catholic lobbies, then it begins to make sense why they did not consider it a legislative priority in Barack Obama's own words. So the fact that, you know, a couple things happened along the way. One is that there was the ability after the death of Antonin Scalia, Barack Obama had the ability to fill the Supreme Court seat, and he did attempt to do so with Merrick Garland. And while many say that, well, Republicans blocked his nominee, he had the ability, if he wanted to make a recess appointment. He could have, while Senate was in recess, could have simply put Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court and chose not to. The Republicans essentially used a non-filibuster filibuster in order to stop that from happening, and he didn't fight back on that. And then Ruth Bader Ginsburg had the opportunity to step down from her seat while she was still alive and during the Barack Obama presidency, but she held on to it. And I am very comfortable saying that she held on to it because the idea was to hand off the presidency to Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton would be able to appoint Ruth Bader Ginsburg's replacement. Unfortunately, that didn't really work out. Donald Trump ended up winning the 2016 election, and the rest is history. Here we are now.
Yeah, well, first of all, making a recess appointment to the Supreme Court would have been wildly, radically controversial. And
I mean, but I don't think
Obama ever even entertained doing it. Yeah, I mean, but I mean, there's a theory that it could have been done. I'm not even sure how that would pan out, and if it would have maybe been overridden. I mean, but that, leaving that aside, I want to just half sarcastically sketch out briefly the case that Susan Sarandon is in fact responsible. And I'm not saying this as a,
I'm not,
yeah. So in 2016, Hillary Clinton was ushered into the Democratic nomination preemptively by these machinations of the party apparatus, even though the component parts of that party apparatus were well aware of her political liabilities, but they felt that she was owed the nomination and the presidency for a variety of harebrained reasons. And over the course of these maneuvers, it came to pass that a significant faction of the Democratic Party, or voters who would be generally inclined to favor Democrats at least over Republicans, were alienated and disenchanted enough by this process, which seemed to be the kind of most emblematic example of the ineptitude and corruption of the Democratic Party. They were alienated enough by this that they either were not going to support Hillary Clinton in the general election, or if they were going to support her, it would be exceedingly begrudgingly, and they wouldn't do any kind of advocacy or canvassing, or they wouldn't deploy the activist energy that they had deployed for Bernie Sanders, who most of them supported in the primaries. Now, what the Hillary Clinton campaign did, what her operatives did when it became clear that there was a larger fissure within the Democratic Party coalition than maybe they wanted to acknowledge, was just sort of pretend that the fissure didn't exist. They covered it up. They berated anyone for even pointing it out. They said that if you spend too much time dwelling on this fissure or the reasons for it, then you are simply helping Trump, and that was tantamount to abetting the rise of fascism. But those kinds of scare tactics and that kind of like political blackmail only goes so far. And so in a pretty close election, at least in at the handful of states that Trump won to make the decisive Electoral College margin, it's conceivable that, for example, like in Wisconsin, where if memory serves, it was only in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan in 2016, only like 40,000 votes or so, I think, could have tipped the balance, right, from Hillary back to Trump or vice versa. And so it's conceivable that although, you know, ideological progressives and leftists and people aligned with a Susan Sarandon type sensibility, although they're not a huge portion of the electorate, they're a large enough portion of the electorate that in an exceedingly close, razor-thin election, where Hillary maybe could have won Wisconsin if she simply boosted turnout around Madison a little more, you know, where these more progressive types are probably going to be located, then maybe she could have won the election. But because she had, because the party and the campaign had done so much to dispirit and antagonize those types of voters, the voters didn't support Hillary Clinton. So, which is all to say, I mean, to me, it's not crazy to say that because of this progressive left-wing Susan Sarandon style alienation with Hillary Clinton in 2016, she didn't get sufficient votes to win the election, or at least that was a contributing factor. Now, it's a whole nother thing to pin personal blame on Susan Sarandon, which is, of course, absurd.
No, but that's what people are doing. It's, I hope you're happy, Susan Sarandon. And that's the wild part to me. It's like, so what you're saying to me, like, imagine what you're saying about your country and about your democracy, is that if one person says, I'm dissatisfied with the outcome of this primary, I believe that it wasn't fair, I will not be voting for Hillary Clinton, as is her right, which, by the way, many of Hillary Clinton's supporters were doing the exact same thing in 2008 when she lost the primary against Barack Obama. I remember, oh my gosh, Evelyn the Rothschild, I believe her name was, one of the Puma voters, said the exact same thing, that she'll be supporting John McCain in the general election rather than Hillary Clinton. Said that on, I believe it was CNN. So to say that Susan Sarandon was then responsible for this outcome, like one person caused a cascading series of events that caused women to lose the right to choose in America. If your democracy depends on the opinion of one person, can you be said to have a functional democracy?
Well, here's what the functional effect is of this, you know, recurring fixation on Susan Sarandon now 6 years later, so long past the point of just total absurdity. The function is that it kind of flips the script in terms of who is responsible for political failures. Because you'll notice they're not pinning blame on Hillary Clinton for failing to run a sufficiently effective campaign to court the requisite number of voters that she needed to win those states. They're pinning the blame on the voter for being dissatisfied with the candidate.
I think I have to stress this. Over Donald Trump, whom she and her husband deliberately attempted, like, were hoping was going to win the Republican primary. That was the outcome they were hoping. And they got embarrassed.
Well, yeah, not just Hillary Clinton was hoping that. I don't recall her specifically trying to engineer that. I'm sure there's some reporting to that effect. But I do know for a fact that some of these liberal media organs during the 2016 Republican primaries overtly boosted Trump, with the idea being, you know, David Corn and Mother Jones being one big example, who then became one of the, you know, the most hardcore Russiagate resistance types, even collaborating with the FBI to try to instigate an investigation against Trump, which did happen successfully, partially at the behest of Corn. During the primaries, the idea was, oh yeah, let's amplify Trump and promote Trump as a potential Republican nominee, because Hillary will definitely beat him, and she might not beat, you know, Marco Rubio or something. And secondarily, nominating Trump will discredit the Republican Party. That was basically the logic at the time. And so, yeah, if you want to assign some sort of causation to the ascendant
of
Trump.
Hold on. No, in the Wikipedia leaks, they showed that there was
WikiLeaks
from
Wikipedia leaks.
Right.
Are there Wikipedia leaks? Those would be interesting.
No, in WikiLeaks, they unearthed an email from Clinton's campaign manager, from Maritza Astor, who was Robbie Mook's assistant. And that was sent to campaign chair John Podesta. And there was foreknowledge that Donald Trump was going to run. And they not only deliberately attempted to push him as a legitimate candidate, keep in mind that when he announced early on, he was a fringe candidate. He had previously run for the Green Party, or at least in the Green Party.
It was the Reform Party, yeah, in 2000.
Yeah, and then ended up dropping out.
Against Pappy Cannon.
And so he was seen as as belonging to the political fringe, but there was a deliberate attempt to legitimize him as a serious candidate. So it's not as if this was only happening in media. It was actually happening within Clinton's campaign. And the DNC were strategizing on Clinton's behalf in order to anticipate this outcome. So I say that that's what they were hoping to happen. I mean, it's not presumption and it's not speculation. It actually did happen.
Yeah. So the point being that there are so many other potential causal factors that they could be fixating on over these past 6 years to explain why it is that Hillary Clinton lost the election and Donald Trump won. And the fact that they always go back to this one scapegoat of Susan Sarandon speaks to, again, what the function of that fixation is, which is to sort of invert the typical relationship between voter and politician to make it seem like if you don't show the politician adequate loyalty, then you are at fault. It's not the politician's fault that you didn't support them. It's not the fault of the politician that they didn't present to you a platform that you felt compelled to vote for. The fault is yours as the voter. And that inverted dynamic, it takes the heat off elites who commit failures. there's hardly a more seismic example of elite failure than the fact that Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 election.
Remember during the Bush years, the common refrain was, if you don't vote, you can't complain. And it was such a common refrain that George Carlin had to, in a comedy special, explain, hang on a second. No. If I don't vote, I definitely can't complain because you can't hang any of this around my neck. I'm not responsible for any of it. So it went from, if you don't vote, you can't complain, to vote blue no matter who. So it's not sufficient that you vote, and it's not sufficient that you exercise your, whether it's like your political sensibilities, vote your conscience, vote your wallet, or any of the other platitudes that they use to try and get people out to the polls in the first place. It went from that to, no, you, the voter, have a responsibility to vote in the direction that we tell you, because if you don't, we can't enact the agenda that we promised you that we were going to carry out. If we win, we're probably not going to carry it out anyway, and if we don't win, we can. So it's like there is no calculus by which they bear any of the responsibility for their failures, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I personally, by and large, stopped voting in 2012. I mean, I'll still occasionally vote for like a ballot measure or maybe in a local, hyper-local race or something. But in terms of national races, I've more or less stopped voting since 2012. And in 2016 and again in 2020, I wrote articles explaining my reasoning for not voting. And I would call it, I don't know if I coined the term, but the term that I came to use for it was conscientious abstention. Because oftentimes, somebody not voting will be automatically construed as like apathy or excess cynicism or something. And maybe there's a cynical dimension to why it is that I chose not to vote. But really, the primary reason was that I had a certain logic that was operative that made it such that in my analysis of either of the two candidates on offer in either of those election cycles, I didn't feel that it was warranted for me to vote for either of them. And, you know, that's a sort of a way that citizens can, by withholding the franchise, citizens can, in a way, participate. Because, you know, if it's obviously it's incredibly at the margins, but one fewer vote for candidates that you don't support is, you know, potentially one fewer vote in their overall total that allows them to claim a mandate for governance or whatever. So I guess what it boils down to is that there are decidedly legitimate rationales that one might proffer for why it is that they don't vote. And, you know, if to the extent that anybody who read my articles in 2016 or 2020, which, you know, explain why I wasn't going to vote for either Hillary or Trump or then Trump or Biden, to the extent that any readers of those articles were persuaded and then also chose not to vote for either of the candidates, then that's the fault of the candidate for having such flaws that potential voters could be persuaded not to support them. It's not the fault of the voter.
It's never the voter. It's always interesting to me that in business we say the customer is always right, but in politics it's always the voter's fault.
Yeah,
right? Like it's not possible for parties to fail you. It's that you failed your party. And the thing is, like how much could, like once you've been elected, that is pretty much it. If you're a House representative, you're held to account by your voters every 2 years. If you're a member of the Senate, you're held to account every 6 years by voters. And if you're president, you're held to account every 4 years. So after everybody goes to the ballot and casts their vote, everything after that is completely on you. And with the amount of gerrymandering, the amount of redistricting, after the amount of the methods that the Republicans have used to essentially reorganize the franchise, they gutting up the Voting Rights Act, for example. You know, after all of that, we know that Democratic voters, especially voters in either majority, minority, or high minority regions, have their vote counts for less. That is, if regardless of the popular vote breaking in Democrats' direction every single time in traditionally Democratic districts, even if it breaks their way 100% of the time, they will not have remotely proportional representation in either the House or the Senate. It is simply impossible. So to pin this on the voters, knowing that voters are being purged from the rolls, that laws are being passed to prevent people from voting, that redistricting in these Jenga and snake-like fashions to make sure that vote is captured among affluent and highly white neighborhoods and zoning out black and brown neighborhoods to make sure that they capture less of the vote and fewer seats. Like, at the moment, it is simply impossible that if all of the traditionally Democratic districts were Democrat, that you would actually have a supermajority in the Senate, enough to break filibuster, and certainly not enough to pass two-thirds of the House.
Yeah, you know, back to the ruling today, and this connects to what we were just talking about, but there could be one potential upside, which is that, you know, one of the reasons that Susan Sarandon gets perennially hectored in this fashion, and the reason why she's getting hectored again today, is because over and over again, every presidential cycle, both parties, Republicans and Democrats, constantly, you know, try to politically blackmail their own voters to compel them to vote for the nominee of the party, even if they don't like the nominee, because, of course, they have to do it for the Supreme Court. So Trump, Republicans did a version of this in 2016 because there was a small but sizable enough contingent of the Republican Party that really did not like Trump, mostly centered on elite factions, but even, you know, amongst some of the more religious conservatives who didn't like his character, thought he was too brusque, didn't trust that he was a true conservative, etc. And You know, so that's why the Trump and the RNC and the Federalist Society coordinated this whole gambit where they, for the first time, released a preset list of conservative justices that he would draw from for his potential Supreme Court nominations. So the idea being, even if you don't like Trump, you got to vote for Trump because of the Supreme Court. And of course, there was the converse of that with Democrats, where, you know, anybody who had a criticism of Hillary Clinton would be immediately greeted with choruses of consternation, whereby they were being instructed that they had to vote for Hillary Clinton, or otherwise Roe versus Wade was going to go kaput. And now that Roe versus Wade has gone kaput, maybe it means that the salience of that political blackmail tactic will have been diminished. So maybe now that pressure point has been removed, and, you know, it finally did pan out, then no longer is it going to be so easy for political elites to, you know, coerce their constituents into voting for a candidate who they otherwise disdain, but are being commanded that they must, otherwise they're handing over the highest court in the land to the enemy. Now, maybe there's going to be some successor case to Roe versus Wade that could play a similar role, but, you know, for almost 50 years, Roe versus Wade has been that case. So it's going to take a while, it's going to be unsettled, and nothing's going to be quite as central to that political blackmail dynamic as Roe versus Wade was probably for quite some time.
Well, I want to make sure that we, you know, spend the majority of our talk today getting opinions from our callers, and there are a few that have been waiting for a little while. And I also did see some people pop up to the caller queue and drop back down. So if you left the caller queue, feel free to pop back up, because we're going to try and get to as many of you as possible. First person I want to speak to is Nick. Go ahead and unmute. The button is in the lower right-hand corner of the screen.
Hey, Q.
Hey, what's up, buddy?
Hey, so I actually kind of appreciated the back and forth of assessment of why people didn't vote Democrat in 2016, and I'm one of them. Proud Jill Stein voter, because fuck the Democratic Party.
Hell yeah.
And I didn't call in for this specifically, but I did just want to add some personal context to why I made that decision. 2015 and 2016 for the Bernie campaign, that was the first time that I actually cared about a Democratic primary. And the further that I got into that, I realized that the actual values that this man stood for was in direct conflict with people that I thought shared those values that were Democrats. Like, the level of hostility and vitriol that I got for even saying, like, people deserved health care and good wages and homes and good jobs was just really mind-blowing. But I basically completely committed to it. And I am not a wealthy person by any means. I believe the maximum donation for that period was $2,700. I put it all on a credit card. I spent years paying it off. But the point is, I poured literally everything that I had into that because it was the one thing that I saw as any way out of what looked like a pretty abysmal future, given what I've already witnessed in my time as an adult. And through all those volunteer efforts, through donations, phone banking, canvassing, standing 4 hours in a gymnasium for a caucus, to realize, like, interacting with other voters around the country that noticed all kinds of bullshit, like, not only the media touting, like, the super delegate votes ahead of time to basically already mire the rest of the public with this idea that it was, you know, basically a fool's errand to even try to do anything other than go along with the Hillary Clinton mission, or, you know, reports of people closing polling sites early or reducing certain communities' access to voting machines. Like, the list just went on. And the thing that I just kind of witnessed and experienced in real time wasn't opposition from Republicans, but opposition from, like, liberals at every single possible, you know what I'm trying to say. The point is, the overwhelming, thank you, yes. And ultimately, my decision to vote for Jill Stein just came from the fact that, like, this party made it absolutely clear that they wanted nothing to do with me. They didn't want my efforts. They didn't want my money. They didn't, like, they were just fine with looking at every bit of effort that I put into this cause and basically telling me that it didn't matter to them at all. And so I took that message and I went third party and independent, and I kind of haven't looked back. I actually, in the state that I live in, I personally delivered the forms and payments to get Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker as counted write-in options in my state for 2020, and proudly voted for them. But the big thing that I want to emphasize about that whole time period and that decision that I think is even funnier, because the liberal focus is all in Jill Stein, or sorry, on Susan Sarandon. But I remember in real time a bunch of celebrity endorsements for Jill Stein. And curiously, they're only going after Susan Sarandon, which is kind of bad optics and really sexist. Like, I remember the rapper Atmosphere was going to do it. Harry Condobolo had her.
Of course, you would blame all of this on a woman.
Of course. And Viggo Mortensen and Russ Rankin from the band Good Riddance, Chris Sheffield from the Foo Fighters. I mean, the point is, she had a lot of support, and a lot of people were willing to kind of say that, you know, the Democratic Party sucks, and somebody has to acknowledge this. And so that's just the context that I want to bring to why I personally fall into this camp. But the reason why I called was, why do you think it is that the liberal response to this that I'm seeing is either these, like, calls for withholding of, you know, sexual acts or pleasure, or trying to get males to go into, like, voluntary vasectomies, or just some sort of, you know, crazy convoluted thing or act of protest that, if anything, would reduce the number of, like, you know, liberal or left-leaning people among the populace and electorate, which is, you know, more or less handing the right what it wants, versus just deciding once to criticize the Democratic Party.
Let me stop you on that one real quick. That one was actually fucking wild. I've seen that one come around. Is that, okay, so the answer to this one is that obviously we should just offer vasectomies, no, sorry, not offer, but we should make vasectomies mandatory for men. And when you want to have a child, you then reverse the vasectomy, and therefore we don't have to worry about possible abortions. To which my answer is, how has, like, in what way can we think of, just off the top of your head, just, I don't know, pick an example. What ways previously have mandatory sterilizations been used against Americans in the past? Is that really where you want to go back to? Like, do you want to go back to the days of, like, you know, sterilizing rural farmers in the Appalachians because they were passing on genes that were clouding up the gene pool with their lack of intelligence and slow wits? Do we want to go back to sterilizing Black women? Do we want to go back to gynecological experiments on Black women in Puerto Rico? Do we want to go back to the Tuskegee experiment, wherein men who were known to have syphilis did not receive treatment, or in many cases received placebos? Like, every time that this has been attempted, where there is an effort by the state or by organizations sponsored by the state to manage people's reproductive capabilities, it has generally resulted in oppressed in being used against minorities, like people of color, used against people of those who are deemed to have limited intellectual capacity. So it has always been racist and ableist, and that's your answer.
And it's doubly ironic too, because the whole creation of Planned Parenthood by Margaret Sanger, you know, say what you will about providing necessary gaps in health coverage and access, but, like, it was started as a negative eugenics thing to, you know, weed out the, I believe it was, like, the genetics of imbecility was her quote.
Yeah, I mean, there were many people, I don't know that, there's been many disputes about whether Margaret Sanger was or was not a eugenicist. But I am quite clear that many progressives' opinions, I mean, the whole concept of progressive politics was born from the idea of progressing the white race. Progressivism, like the actual word progressivism, which was a concept that came about in the years of Theodore Roosevelt in the late 19th century, progressivism meant advancing the genetics and capabilities of the white race. So this, all of these ideas, like, it's kind of wild, because all of these ideas, if you take them back far enough, where it comes to everything from medical assistance in dying, like we have up here in Canada, we do have assisted suicide, to state managed reproduction, to even managing mental health, much of this has its roots in ableism and the quest to either reduce, decrease mental faculty in white people, or managing the reproductive rates of black and indigenous and Hispanic people, and also, and also managing the amount of "quote unquote" mongrelization that was being brought up from the Texas-Mexico border. Sorry, go ahead.
Do you mind if I add one last thing?
Yes, I actually wanted to ask you a question, but go ahead. Yeah, and I'll ask you. After you make your point.
And just kind of, I was just trying to get a bit of an answer, and it's not even rhetorical. I would like to know how to convey this to a person. How do you think, in your assessment, you could convince somebody to start actually looking at the Democratic Party with a critical lens rather than going for all of these like lofty, weird ideas to kind of cure this cultural moment that are like insane to the average person?
I will say I'm going to make my book of recommendations, and then Michael, you can take it away.
Okay.
So there's two very good books that I would recommend to just about anybody. One is War Against the Weak. So it actually goes into very explicit detail about a facility for eugenics that was founded in North Carolina and which had multi-party support. So it's called War Against the Weak. It's by Edwin Black. Published in, I want to say it was like 2002 or 2003. Another really good book on the matter is Capitalism and Disability. And I mean, from there, you can, you know, if you look at the footnotes and you look at who the authors cite or who they say their influences are, you can really take it from there. But there's plenty of information that's wide open. On top of that, there's the funny part is people think that, you need to derive all of your sources from left-wing or from progressive sources, because if you read right-wingers, well, they're only going to offer right-wing points of view. But the funny thing is, if you read right-wing authors, you can find some really interesting information about the history of progressivism. One of them, by Thomas C. Leonard, who is, I believe he worked for the von Mises Institute, but he wrote a book called Illiberal Reformers. Illiberal Reformers, race, eugenics. Hang on a second here. It's open in my Kindle library right now. I was just reading it like 3 or 4 days ago. Liberal Reformers, Thomas E. Leonard. Go and check that out.
Well, thanks. And you had a question for me, Michael?
Yeah, I do actually, because I think maybe one way to go about answering the question you just posed is for me to ask you a follow-up question, because I found your tale of your political odyssey throughout 2016 and then onwards very interesting. And
I'm glad someone did.
And I wanted to ask maybe for you to reflect on something, which is that, you know, as I'm sure I don't have to remind you, once Bernie Sanders dropped out of that race, he began to launch a full-time advocacy campaign on behalf of Hillary Clinton. And of course, he didn't seem to really get much credit for that, at least among certain quarters afterwards, because they blamed him anyway for Hillary's loss. But he did go around and very diligently campaign for Hillary Clinton, encourage his supporters to vote for Hillary Clinton, and so forth. And one of his key rationales is directly relevant to, you know, the impetus for this conversation today, which is that it had to be done for the Supreme Court. And so I'm wondering, you know, I assume that you probably lament this decision today. And so in hindsight, what do you feel about like the 2016 era argument that many people, including Bernie himself, advance, which is that, you know, whatever your reservations about the Democratic nominee, you do have to vote for the Democratic nominee because of this whole, you know, cosmic importance of the Supreme Court argument that perennially gets dredged up to, you know, as I mentioned before, Hector, alienated voters to, you know, line up behind their party.
Well, personally, the way that I saw it was I encountered so much bad faith criticism that didn't hold any water, that fell apart at the slightest bit of scrutiny. I just started to like not really take them at their word, because if you look at that critically, like you said, Obama supermajority with the Democratic Party, did they do anything about, gun control or abortion? No. Did Ruth Bader Ginsburg decide to retire when she was diagnosed with cancer? No. did, you know, you just kind of go through this list of that they have demonstrated at every conceivable point their unwillingness to actually do anything to help anybody and constantly scapegoating something else, never taking any sort of personal action for anything. And another thing about this too, and I was really upset with Bernie. I was actually very vocally critical of him both in 2016 and 2020 for ultimately caving to endorsing the other Democratic candidate. I went for it again in 2020 just because I had hoped that he had kind of, you know, had his come to Jesus moment and changed that ultimate betrayal that it resulted in. I haven't really followed Bernie since then. I feel pretty betrayed overall. But of course, the other hilarious context of this whole thing that you have to remember is 2016, after that primary, whenever the public or, you know, media or overall eye was cast on Jill Stein, she was met with constant derision. Like, you don't need to take this person seriously. The Democratic Party's win is so shored up and a sure thing that you don't even need to think about this person. All of their followers are just like, you know, silly, histrionic losers. Nothing that they say or do matters. And of course, once Hillary loses, coalition of voters suddenly becomes public enemy number one. And of course, they did the exact same thing to Ralph Nader, which is discovering Ralph Nader and his story is another reason why I've come to these conclusions of just not trusting the Democratic Party at their word anymore.
Okay, but be that as it may, meaning that your ascription of bad faith or unreliability to Democrats might be perfectly reasonable, and I would probably even personally agree with a lot of those points. But be that as it may, I am still curious that what did pan out is that Trump did win the election, and then he did appoint three conservative Supreme Court justices, and that was decisive in leading to the outcome that we see today. In light of that, and setting aside whatever criticisms you might have of the Democrats' bad faith, which, again, I think are probably perfectly valid.
It's just, if I'm supposed to feel bad about that, shouldn't they feel bad about not pushing for Neil Gorsuch?
I'm not asking if you should feel bad about it. I'm asking if you, in hindsight, think there was any salience to or legitimacy to that argument that was advanced back in 2016, which is that, look, you have to support the Democratic nominee because of the Supreme Court, leaving aside any other objections you might have. Do you think there's any salience to that in hindsight or not?
Nothing that I have encountered in the last 7 years would have led me to believe that that promise was the least bit sincere.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well,
you can move on to the next caller. Yeah. Thank you.
I would say that knowing that there was a high likelihood due to the link from wherever it came in the Supreme Court, that there was a likely decision coming down that would strike down Roe v. Wade, and that the Democrats continued to support an anti-choice candidate in a in a pivotal election, does show the lack of sincerity around that rhetoric to me.
I don't know. I mean, I think Democrats actually were pretty sincere, and I wouldn't necessarily give them credit for sincerity for its own sake. But I think, you know, Democratic elites are pretty sincere when they express such anxiety and apprehension about the idea of the Supreme Court being taken over by a conservative majority and then striking down Roe versus Wade. I don't see any reason to doubt why that should have been a sincere worry that they expressed, because it was true. I mean, there is a conservative legal establishment that was gradually trying to field candidates to eventually overturn Roe versus Wade.
No, I'm not saying that they weren't sincere about their worry that Roe v. Wade could be overturned. I'm saying I doubt their sincerity and their commitment to protecting a woman's right to choose. I think that then the political calculus is that if they can keep campaigning on this issue, they can keep fundraising on it. And if they can fundraise on it in perpetuity, then there really is no need. Because once you've actually enshrined it in law, now you have to find some other means of fundraising. You have to find some other central and pivotal issue to send email blasts out to all of your supporters to ask them for money.
On that point, what have
correct
they
answer.
On that point, what have they done, meaning Democrats, what have they done in the almost 2 months since that draft opinion was leaked, which showed almost conclusively that Roe versus Wade was going to be overturned? And it could have been predicted anyway, going back
months and even years. I mean, it was pretty clear at oral argument last November for this case that overturned Roe that probably that was going to be the outcome.
What have they fundraised and tried to jill Stein harder.
It seems like they've really just been focused on like arming Ukraine.
Oh, that too. I got to go, but thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks, Nick. I just want to point out that I'm not endorsing that logic of the political blackmail to coerce wary Democratic leaning voters to support the nominee. I'm just sort of trying to suss out whether that logic has some kind of at least consistency or merit in its formulation. And I think it actually probably does. It's not a logic that I embrace. I still reject it for my own reasons. But I think someone who reasons in a direction that lands them on, okay, I have to support the Democratic nominee or even the Republican nominee if you're hardcore anti-abortion, I think it makes sense. And, you know, the Republicans employing that tactic successfully with Trump, you know, bore a lot of fruit.
Yeah. No, I agree that they were sincerely worried about that outcome. But I don't have any faith in their sincerity about protecting a woman's right to choose, or frankly, many of the other issues that they would campaign on. Whether it's
actually, just point of information on that, I live in New Jersey, and actually on a state level in New Jersey, the Democratic-controlled legislature and governor did just pass a bill codifying, I don't know if it's codifying Roe versus Wade exactly, but codifying
a right to
an abortion.
Yeah, guess the issue there, where I have a contention with that, is that now there is no federal guideline on the matter. So it's up to states to make their own decisions. And the problem is, if you live in a state that does outlaw abortion, they've already thought ahead as to, well, what if they leave the state to go ahead and get an abortion? Because you can be pursued criminally. You could be prosecuted for leaving the state for the purposes of getting an abortion.
Well, Kavanaugh, in his concurrence in the decision today, and I haven't read the whole decision because it's really long and in depth, but Kavanaugh actually disclaims that it would be constitutional to... Because what Kavanaugh interestingly seems to be doing in a lot of these decisions is writing a concurrence to sort of moderate the scope of how the decision can be potentially interpreted. So, like, yesterday, Clarence Thomas goes wild on this unwieldy historical disquisition on gun regulations in the U.S., and then Kavanaugh does this little follow-up concurrence where he clarifies that, you know, even though this law in New York was struck down, that doesn't mean the court is still not opining one way or another on the constitutionality of any given gun regulation. Therefore, states can still draft and enact their own gun regulations, and this ruling has nothing to do with it, except that the states now must use the style of licensing regime that is already operative in 43 states, and New York's one of the seven, or maybe it was six states that had this other kind of regime. So anyway, Kavanaugh did the same thing today in this ruling on overturning Roe, and he at least claimed that the decision should not be construed to opine on the constitutionality of, for example, prosecuting someone for transiting state lines to get an abortion. He actually said he would be of the view that that was not constitutional to prosecute that person because of the right of interstate travel. Now, how binding that is, because it was a concurrence, I'm not sure. It leaves it open to debate and interpretation, but he at least did say that, you know, just as a point of information.
Right. I mean, to the extent that that's even a guideline, really depends on whether a state attempts to prosecute somebody for that exact reason, and then it has to be run up the flagpole.
Yeah.
So we have some ideas as to what the outcome might be, but the fact of the matter is, at the moment, states still have the ability to file for the prosecution, and it's up to the plaintiff it's up to the defendant in the matter to carry it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Or have that struck down by a lower court. So it's anybody's guess at this point. Andrew, what's up?
Hello. A couple comments, and I have a question for both of you. I'll make it quick. First of all, I do truly believe that the Democrats would be better off running on forced male vasectomy than they would be on January 6th. So I think that's my first point. Secondly, As far as Nick was saying with feeling betrayed by Bernie, I very similar story. I didn't put up the money, but I was putting up the time and effort as the vice president of the Bernie Sanders for President student organization at my university at the time in 2015. And when he immediately endorsed Clinton, I saw it as a gigantic betrayal of everything that he said he was running on, a revolution, and for, you know, talking points on a party platform that was going to be thrown in the dumpster. So,
Andrew, I mean, isn't it, sorry to interrupt, but isn't it in a way your own fault for having felt like you were betrayed, only in the sense that...
Yes. Oh, no, I wasn't bamboozled.
Bernie never said, hey, I'm going to run third party, or I'm not going to support... No. He always pledged to support the Democratic nominee, so...
It wasn't a surprise to me, but it was also in direct conflict with his idea that he was running for a revolution. And that obviously is a very subjective term, but to me it didn't mean endorsing Clinton and not getting anything out of it. If he was going to endorse, I was expecting something serious, I wasn't expecting something serious, but would have satisfied me if there was some kind of campaign finance. At least there would have been some kind of effort. As I saw it, it was just, like I said, I wasn't surprised, because you're right. He said the entire time, just like Tulsi said the entire time, that they would endorse, and I didn't endorse. I wasn't supporting Bernie in 2020. I was supporting Tulsi in 2019. And she said the entire time, I'm going to endorse Biden. And when she did,
And yet people still said they were betrayed. Yeah.
I wasn't feeling that same betrayal, but I was feeling like, sadness. Like, it's like, seeing your dog die or something. It's like, the day's coming,
Well, that's a little bitch.
Well, I put a lot of heart in that one. And
I think, thinking about the 2016,
I'm literally standing next to my dog right now as you said that. Thanks.
In 2016, I actually did a big article in the Daily Beast and some other stuff on this phenomenon of Bernie Sanders supporters not falling in line in the general election, because I felt it was an underexamined dynamic that could actually have some genuine electoral ramifications. And I sketched out the case for that earlier, which is to say that, who can know if a certain percentage of alienated progressives had been adequately quartered in Wisconsin, that Hillary might have won Wisconsin or something like that, But I ended up, I talked to a lot of these Bernie Sanders delegates who at the 2016 Democratic Convention in Philadelphia basically launched a revolt where they were booing Hillary Clinton during the speech and the media wouldn't cover it. They were booing that deranged screed that General John Allen gave, who was like the big military supporter of Hillary Clinton, who just resigned from the Brookings Institution as the CEO because he's under investigation for accepting illicit influence from Qatar.
Interesting.
Anyway, side note. I had a lot of sympathy and even affinity for those types of people back in 2016, but I do recall being a little dubious about this notion that they would often express, meaning basically of just a variation on what you expressed, that they felt betrayed or that they felt that they had been hoodwinked. And any kind of dispassionate assessment of Bernie Sanders' career since he had been in Congress, and just like kind of looking at the plain meaning of the words that he spoke, should have told them that they ought not to feel betrayed by Bernie Sanders supporting the Democratic nominee, because that's what he's done for decades. But at the same time, I could understand it if you had just only been recently energized to enough to follow politics or participate in politics, that maybe just kind of this impressionistic take you had on the nature of the Bernie campaign gave you a sense that political revolution, as he put it, meant not acceding to the demands of the Democratic Party power structure, even though he never really meant it that way.
Yeah, I would say that I felt betrayed at the time, and I was naive, but in retrospect, I would agree with you these days. Anyway, the point of saying that was just to say that I don't think that it necessarily means that the entire thing about the Supreme Court, that's a separate issue to me. I kind of wanted to ask two questions to both of you. one for each of you. For Q, I know you come from a leftist background and you're very knowledgeable, and so I would like to know what the conception of rights are from a leftist, maybe communist or Marxist perspective, because from my understanding of Marx, that government and these ideas like rights are part of a superstructure that is upholding capitalism and is a facade to essentially pacify the people and protect the rights of capital. And that's why rights exist, is for capital. So as far as leftists and views on rights, I understand where a right-wing or traditionalist American view of rights comes from. You know, they're like inalienable and God-given, and then we wrote them down, and these are the ones. And I just would like to know, from a leftist perspective, how you see rights in general and the concept of them and that kind of a thing. And then from Michael, I had a separate question I'll ask after, if you don't mind.
Sure. So to really understand like Marxism and rights, you should probably, like, Marx derives much of his theory from Hegel. And so, I really fucking hate to say this, but to get to the bottom of that, you would have to understand Hegel's theories of phenomenology.
I'm just going to admit that I've been told to read Hegel starting in college and just never did.
If I am not, like, I feel like it would be intellectual abuse for me to recommend the listener to this podcast go and read Phenomenology as Theory by Hegel. What I probably would say, and I hope I get this right, is that his idea of rights, under capitalism, rights spring from people's relation to property. Whereas with Marx, under capitalism, essentially you don't really have rights. Your rights are subject to abrogation, and they can be stripped away from you at any time, because as long as the class antagonisms aren't transcendent, i.e. as long as a class struggle still exists, and we don't live in any, as long as we don't live in a socialist society, even though rights may be enshrined for you constitutionally, or at least, you know, that they say they are, it's a facade. What it essentially is to tell you that there are certain liberties that you're able to claim and undertake, but you have no ability on your own to change you have no ability to change the system. You have no say politically, economically, by yourself, socially, or any of that. And at whatever point the majority choose to take your rights away from you, they can do so. So I guess, like, to give a broad and maybe like a vulgar overview, the answer is that under capitalism, you don't really have rights. The idea of rights springs forward from like a social consensus as to what our rights ought to be. And because the purpose of capital is to protect property right for the bourgeois class, yours are always up for debate.
Right.
Their rights are to benefit off of your labor and assume unto themselves and acquire unto themselves whatever rights they choose. And your rights are to basically advocate for yourself, but you have no power to enforce them.
Well, I think that very directly relates to the idea of abortion and rich people just being able to have access to abortion quite easily, while the poor, it's a
pretty much
layer
pretty
of
much.
Class
yeah.
warfare.
Yeah.
But sorry to be a stickler, because I'm a little, you know, I'm interested and I know you're learned and well-read, which is, excuse me, why I'm asking this. But in a non-capitalist world, what would rights exist? Or are you saying, like, a Max Stirner level, like, they're a spook? There are spooks that society just makes up and we agree with rights.
So here's the thing. Under communism, like at the final stage of communism, the concept of rights is more or less unnecessary because the reason that we have rights and laws in the first place, and the rights are enforced, sorry, the laws are enforced by court bodies, and enforcement of state law is undertaken by special classes of armed men, as Engels calls it. What we call rights and jurisprudence is more or less like, it's a matter of trying to soothe these past antagonisms. They can't be resolved, but at the very least, they can be papered over and obscured. So by saying that you have rights, what you're also saying is that there is a state body which can either enforce them or take them away. And if you live under the state, you don't actually live under a communist form, because the ultimate goal of communism is the total dissolution of the state. So when workers and, you know, when the working class, I should say, not workers, but when the working class owns the means of production, owns the direction of enterprise, etc., then there would be no state for which rights have to either be defended or advocated for expanding. Does that make sense?
In a sense, I guess, you know, this, I don't want to bore everyone, and like, I find it interesting, but I know we might be out of balls in this. But I would have other questions. I would like to pick your brain at some other time about the idea of freedom, and in a communist society, would freedom be like rights, in which they wouldn't be necessary or not existent, and because of the resolved tensions between classes and the dissolution of the state, if that would be like a utopian thing, or, you know,
right.
Anyway. For Michael, if you don't mind moving on, I had a question about the impact of this politically.
Let's keep going with the Marxist study session.
Oh, I know you love that so much.
I find it. I find it peripherally interesting. I'll say
no,
that.
I was gonna say, I love that.
Well, I think it informs a lot of what's going on. Honestly,
yeah, no, I think it's fair.
People's the roots of people's thoughts, even if they don't know that these are the roots.
Yeah.
I love at any point in time I can be called on to like expound on Marxist theory. I love that responsibility
in
the show.
So yeah, for Michael, maybe more relevant and interesting, what is the political fallout of this? Because I've gone back and forth in my mind thinking that the Republicans would pay a price politically somehow if they overreach with, you know, the idea that they're going to overturn this and then like 25 states just outright ban it or something. But then I thought, you know, why would you vote for a Democrat? And today, that was reinforced heavily as like a resolution of this. Why would you vote for a Democrat? Because their answer to this, I don't know if you saw this, was to apparently just sing on the Capitol steps, God Bless America.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting here thinking,
that's what they did after 9/11.
Yeah, well, I guess that's just like a knee-jerk reaction. It's that or the kente cloth, right?
Well, I do the same thing. Whenever there's trouble, I just head outside and start singing God Bless America.
It's just astounding because, you know, like everyone said, they've had time to do things and they've done nothing, and now they're singing on the court steps. And it's like, okay, so what's the argument to vote for you here exactly? Like, what's the argument to even be involved in the Democratic Party at this point?
Honestly. Well, I said this before, I don't know if you heard it, but again, far be it for me to rush to the defense of Democrats, but they have been doing something. I mean, if you're into abortion rights and you want to protect abortion rights, Democrats have done some stuff on the state level. I just mentioned an example of they codified the right to an abortion here in New Jersey just a couple months ago in anticipation of this decision. And I think there are other examples akin to that in some other states. Like, I think, didn't Newsom in California pledge that they're going to underwrite the ability of people from states where abortion is now outlawed to come to California? You know, so there's been stuff like that. So I think fixating on the national level might be a bit of a misnomer, but I mean, I know what you mean.
Yeah, like how will that impact the national election? Because I thought maybe Republicans would pay a price, but I just don't know anymore.
Yeah, as to the political reverberations, first of all, I don't know. I'm not going to be one of these guys who just starts to pontificate as though I have some kind of conclusive theory as to what the impact of this is going to be. I can just give you some first blush thoughts, because obviously I've seen it being floated that this is going to backfire on Republicans, and maybe the momentum that have been going against Republicans I'm sorry, the momentum that had been going against Democrats recently, like on the culture war front, and just the unpopularity of Biden and the economic downturn and whatever, looking like it's going to be a huge rout in November in the midterms. And maybe this could somewhat blunt that trend in the Democrats' favor. I mean, I think that's conceivable, but I think there are a number of potential complications. Which is,
okay, so on just the most basic level, what, let's say that you're like a swing voter or something in Virginia, and you're kind of vaguely pro-abortion, maybe you don't like the fact that this decision came down, and you sympathize with people in Louisiana and South Dakota or whatever who now have, live in states that have harshly banned abortion. Like, what good is it going to do for you to vote for a Democratic member of Congress in November? In other words, how does that address the problem? I'm not clear on how it does. And on top of that, I'm not clear on how high this issue is in terms of salience for the people that Democrats are supposing that they're going to court. You know, I think it seems to me anyway that anti-abortion activists have generally been more single-mindedly motivated by that issue than pro-abortion activists. It probably has to do with, like, you know, theological impetus and whatnot. So I guess I'm just not sure how much this is going to dictate voting behavior on the part of people who want to feel like they want to take some kind of retribution against the fact of this decision coming down. And I think, you know, one potential point of piece of evidence for that is, you know, when the decision was first announced, and even in the preceding days or even weeks, I don't know if you also saw this, but I definitely saw it being speculated largely by people on the right. But even you saw Biden today saying, you know, please, if you're going to protest, don't be violent, which is an indication that they're at least expecting or potentially expecting some civil unrest or widespread, large-scale protest, you know, redolent of what happened in 2020. And having personally covered the 2020 civil unrest pretty in-depth, meaning physically in person all around the U.S., I just don't see it reaching that magnitude by a country mile.
Not even close. I agree with you completely. It's not the same energy.
At the worst,
a lot of people with hats.
At the worst, we're going to get pink pussy hats redux. At the worst.
Completely.
But I don't even think you'll get that because, I mean, maybe it's an oversimplification, but however simple it is, I think it's true. I mean, the reason why the pussy hats thing happened was because Trump said something about grabbing a pussy, and so they made a hat out of it. I mean, right. So, you know, which is a frivolous way of saying that the key variable there in terms of accelerating all this left liberal street activism and energy and agitation that we saw through from 2016 to 2020, it was because of the personage of Trump. It was because Trump was the specter that always loomed over everything and therefore kind of lent any political activity this air of fervency and urgency. And I'm just not sure that just generalized sense of fervent urgency is really there today, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, this decision came down. So, I mean, I think, you know, another distinction that I was just trying to tease out when I was thinking about it earlier, I did a Twitter thread, but, you know, the reason that that the 2020 protest unexpectedly became the most large-scale protest movement in U.S. history, at least that's what the New York Times declared, was because there was a ton of just organic, self-motivated organizing amongst people who were for whom the issue of racial equity or justice or however you want to put it, police accountability, that whole cluster of issues, that was of extraordinarily high salience for them.
Yeah.
To the point that they would start organizing amongst themselves for the first time. I mean, it's still amazing to think back on. I would go, I mean, people associate those protest movements with the big cities, and there obviously were a lot of protest actions and, you know, unrest in big cities, and I went to a lot of the cities, but almost in a way more anthropologically interesting was the fact that the scope of those protests and just the various, you know, actions that took place reached deep into suburban and even rural America. I mean, you should bring up there's like a map that somebody did at one point in 2020 showing everywhere in the U.S. where protest activities took place during that, you know, month or two. And they're like all over the entire country, including, like, you know, middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. I personally went to a protest in basically exurban semi-rural Pennsylvania, just because I happened to be traversing that area. And it was a pretty large protest, you know, and even in my hometown in New Jersey, where I would never have in a million years thought that there would be a protest march stomping down the main thoroughfare, there was one, and it was organized basically by the high school kids. And then the parents, like, endorsed it and helped to sponsor it. And, yeah. And you know, and so, I mean, and that was like a gigantic revolution in raising the political consciousness of a huge amount of people. And I think people are committing a category error if they think about this in anything like the same terms, because for one thing, the driving force between whatever protest actions do take place, and you even see this happening now, I think literally right now there's something at the Supreme Court, but it's one of these more just conventional, you know, protests organized by a professional class Democratic Party pro-abortion group. That's not how those protests in 2020 became so ubiquitous. It was,
no, there was
round up.
Yeah, it was a confluence of events that led up to the 2020 protests. And I don't know that we're going to be able to capture that energy ever again. The fact that it was essentially, you know, it was diverted into Democratic politics was probably the biggest betrayal of it. And it was really the fact that we were all scared to fucking death. We were under lockdown. We had a pandemic that we had no idea at that time how to solve. So we had no vaccine on the horizon because we hadn't even really figured out how the disease was spread in the first place. So people were on edge. And on top of that, you had the fact that even though police were enforcing laws, keeping people indoors and enforcing curfews and so on, the first set of fears that came out immediately, and you saw people talking about this on social media and it was being talked about by YouTubers, etc., is, can we trust the police to do their jobs? Can we trust the police to protect people? Or are they going to continue with the same pattern of enacting brutality and killing Black people without good cause? Are they going to continue in this path that are they going to see down the trajectory? And the problem with, first it was Ahmaud Arbery, which was a couple of vigilantes killed this Black kid while he was out jogging and touring around the neighborhood. And then where it came to George Floyd, I think we were pretty much at a breaking point. And watching Derek Chauvin kneel on his neck for that long until he expired, I think that broke something in people's collective psyche. And you're not going to be able to make that combination of social tension and state violence. It's not going to happen again.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the reason I brought that up was just to answer Andrew's question about what do I think are the potential political ramifications of this. You know, if it could be taken as a harbinger, meaning this comparative analysis between the conditions of today for protest versus 2020, then those conditions have radically dwindled. And so I think maybe that could be at least one indication that the salience that a lot of Democrats think is going to be attached to this issue might not be. I think it's feasible that around the margins, maybe in certain suburban areas with like swing voter type Republican women or something, that maybe this could have, or not even Republican, but, you know, maybe moderate women or whatever. Or not just women, but you know what I mean. Among a certain slice of the electorate, this might have some marginal impact that could affect outcomes in maybe a handful of House races or something. But I think in the main, it's premature to say that this just obviously redounds to the benefit of Democrats.
Yeah, I would agree. And I ask you just because I thought you're very prescient with your comments in 2015 about Biden. I really didn't think he was going to be the nominee until I started
2019,
like halfway through.
Or 2019, I was ruthlessly trolled by everybody. I'm glad you remember this, actually. I was ruthlessly attacked by everybody for just saying that Biden was a strong candidate and likely to win the nomination.
It was absolutely right.
2019 was when that meme went around about you getting a tombstone pile drive by Maxine Waters. And I was like,
oh, God,
why is everybody so mad at dude? But, you know,
they heard some truth. They got mad.
people. That's what yeah. Like,
I can never. It's hard to keep track of why exactly people are mad at me any given day. It tends to vary.
Well, I have taken. I was going to say I've taken, I think, enough of your time, and I thank you for both your time. And I just want to say God bless the United Oblasts of Ukraine. And I can't wait to see Ben Stiller play Zelensky in the upcoming film. I can't wait. So thanks, guys.
Slava Ukraini.
Slava Ukraini.
All right. Next caller, Pierre. I hope you got something good for us, because I'm now sliding into the doldrums of depression. Lower right-hand corner to unmute your microphone. The microphone-shaped object.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm somewhere between a leftist and a liberal centrist, but I hear a lot of leftists derisively use phrases like vote blue, no matter who, and all that similar rhetoric. But I think the idea of strategic voting is underrated. I agree that no Democratic or swing voter is quote unquote obligated to vote for any Democratic candidate, and candidates should feel obligated to motivate their base and persuade base and swing voters. But yep. It's just a fact that under our system with party primaries and first past the post elections, that a two-party system is simply the reality. And voting is not a method of personal fulfillment, where if you don't agree with nearly 100% of the candidate's platform, that you should abstain because they don't exactly line up with your views. Why shouldn't you what?
Why shouldn't you abstain if your candidates don't align with your views?
Well, in a two-party system, you have to make a choice. And I think that ideally, our system would be different. There's evidence that the existence of party primaries is why we have a two-party system. Ideally, of course,
we don't have to make the choice, right? There's no legal requirement to make the choice.
Well, no, I don't mean that, but I mean strategic voting. People kind of dismiss it. And I think that there's plenty of ways to move political factions in different directions in between voting booth, in between general elections. So there's activism, there's trying to pull the party in different directions in the primaries. But there's a very short time period or very small act of literally voting in a general election that does require a binary choice. And that's the one instance in which someone, in order that for their voice to be heard, gets to be heard, is making it in a binary system. You've got to be able to make that choice. And then the rest of the time, yes, you can do activism and do all that, but yes, there is one situation in which you do have to make a binary choice if you want to influence where the country is going.
I think there's a coherent case to be made for strategic voting, depending on what your priorities are, depending on what your principles are. But I also think there's a coherent case to be made for other approaches to voting. So I'm just wondering if you would grant that somebody whose philosophy on voting sort of rejects that you, quote, have to. I was being facetious when I said it. There's no legal requirement.
Well,
but
yeah.
Do you think there's a coherent case to be made? Like, for me, and just who cares about me, right? But I'm most familiar with myself. And for whatever reason, years ago, maybe it was because I came of age during the Iraq War, and that was like the singular event that informed my political consciousness. But for whatever reason, I kind of just came to resolve that, unlike 99% of the rest of the population, when I'm making a choice to vote or not vote for a presidential candidate, the number one issue that I'm going to prioritize is foreign policy, because that's a huge anomaly. Most voters do not particularly prioritize foreign policy, unless there's an unusual situation happening, like Vietnam or Iraq or whatever. And because often, ever since I've started voting. Actually, I voted for Obama in 2008. I mean, I did volunteer actively for Obama in 2008. This was pre, journalism or media. But since then, and I was partially on foreign policy grounds because he was, at least nominally against the Iraq War. But ever since then, my decision-making calculus has been guided by my prioritization of foreign policy, and therefore it made it untenable for me to vote for Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Mitt Romney, et cetera. Do you think that's reasonable? Can you understand that? Do you think that that's a coherent approach, or would you condemn it as naive because it doesn't subscribe to your quote unquote have to vote binary philosophy?
I think that there is an element of foreign policy consensus between the two parties, and that's a reasonable reason why people might feel disengaged. But I think the part of the reason of foreign policy consensus is the structure of our political system, which makes it hard for varying political factions to work for the reasons I said before. And I think that, yeah, it's hard to make those choices, but there is enough difference between the parties and foreign policy to make a determination in literally that one instance where you do need to make a binary choice on general election day.
What if you're going to make that choice on regards to their policy towards the Ukraine-Russia conflict?
Yeah, I was going to ask about, like, how would you summarize what you're saying is that sort of discernible distinction between the two parties on foreign policy that would force you to make the binary choice on election day?
Well, a lot of people would, you know, said, oh, well, Trump was better at foreign policy in terms of, you know, compared to, and it's true that Trump didn't start any new wars, did keep delaying and withdrawal, and there's no guarantee if he had been reelected that he would have stuck with it. Biden took a lot of political damage for following through on it, and people don't give him credit for that. I think
I did, by the way. I gave him credit. I mean, I'm a pretty harsh critic of Democrats and Biden and whatever, but I spent a month last summer fending off ridiculous bad faith attacks by right wingers on Biden for the Afghanistan withdrawal, just so you know. And even when Tucker Carlson had made the case.
Right. As far as Ukraine funding, here's the thing. I agree that there needs to be some more of what the end game is. But I don't actually think that Republicans, and it's true that, like, okay, you could say, well, it doesn't matter what their motivation is, but it's just a statement vote if they can't get enough people to vote against it. And, you know, it's a messaging vote in that sense. And you really can't tell. I mean, if Trump was elected and he was
I just want to offer one clarification, though. So we're talking about, you're saying strategic voting, where you're not talking about a binary option between Republicans or Democrats. As we've been talking about for probably about the last 40 or so minutes, the options are actually between voting Republican, voting Democrat, or abstaining from voting. So I guess the question to ask here is why then regarding the absence of difference on foreign policy, why is the Republican opinion on the matter remotely salient?
And let me just add something real quick, Pierre, before you answer that. I would concede readily that if you have at the top of your, like, priority hierarchy, let's say, the preservation of Roe versus Wade, then strategic voting probably does make sense, and there probably is a coherent argument for it. But if at the top of your priority hierarchy, like me, happens to be foreign policy, there really is not nearly as straightforward of a coherent case for strategic voting. So for example, because you've talked about the Afghanistan withdrawal under Biden and the Ukraine funding, whatever, but that doesn't really get to the key question of that you raised, which is that if you're at the voting booth in November of 2020, or you were filling out your mail-in ballot, and you were down to this binary decision, given the information available then, I'm still not clear on why it should have been so obvious that strategic voting ought to have compelled you to vote for Biden. To be clear, I don't think it compelled you to vote for Trump either, right? But I don't know what that case is.
I agree. In the primaries, for example, I spent way too much time on Medicare for All, which is I support, but which is just unrealistic to pass politically because of, you know, the system we have, and not enough time on areas where the president has a lot of leeway, which is foreign policy. So I agree that if that's your main issue, that makes things a little more of a conundrum. But I would push back on saying that the two parties are exactly the same on foreign policy. You knew what you got.
Well, I didn't say that either, did I?
Well, I don't know. Okay, not exact, but that it was a toss-up.
I just I wasn't saying they're the same. I don't think they're the same. I mean, they have some key differences. Iran is a perennial one. But
when you say, oh,
so yeah, I'm not saying that they're the same. I'm saying that there's not enough of a glaring, obvious distinction between the two of them that would make it obvious why one candidate should be voted for over the other.
Then you're basically vouching for politicalism and dropping the system, unless you have a coherent plan for changing the underlying political system. But I've not seen a realistic plan for how to change that system. That system is pretty well entrenched, and you're not going to see that any difference. So I think that in general, you're going to have this for at least the foreseeable future. And if you want to drop out of that system, then that's fine. But that's, I mean, this is politics, right? And if you have every time in between the general election votes to push whatever poll you find most affiliated with in one direction or another. And I think Bernie Sanders, obviously, on the, you know, the spectrum, and then Trump on the right, there was, you know, molding and sorting political along those lines. But once you actually get to that voting booth in that one day or one afternoon of going to that voting booth, yeah, that is one area in which you do have to make a binary choice.
I just don't accept that declining to make that binary choice is necessarily reflective of nihilism. I mean, it may be, or it may not be. Like, you may be not declining to vote because you're saying, oh, I don't care, nothing matters. Or you might be choosing to not vote because you think a lot of things actually do matter, and you're choosing to exercise or not exercise your franchise in furtherance of your values because you do think things matter. So I think that caricature that it's just automatically a nihilistic kind of dropping out of the system or whatever, I think that's just a totally unfair caricature.
I think that makes way too many assumptions about what people place priority on and what they find important. And it also, when you say things like, well, just because you didn't get everything you want, you're assuming that there is anything that the voter wants on offer. So people make a habit of saying, oh, just because the left didn't get everything they want, then my question is, all right, well, what did they get that they actually wanted? They wanted student loan debt relief, and now there's a possibility that they may get $10,000 when what was promised and put on offer previously was $50,000. When, by the way, the president, through the Secretary of Education, has the ability to direct the secretary to simply waive all federal student loan debt. There's also the matter of universal health care. There's a matter of foreign policy, i.e. United States withdrawing from constant and never-ending warfare. There's, you know, more money towards education, infrastructure, so on and so on. So there's any number of issues that the left raised during the 2020 primary. And Biden never expressed interest in honoring any of them. So I guess my question then is, if you're saying that you should vote strategically in order to at least get some of what you want and compromise, my question then becomes, all right, well, what if nothing that you want is on offer from either candidate? Why then do you have the obligation?
Well, I would say that that's exactly why you would strategically vote in that instance in the general election, is because you get at least a portion of your agenda. Or if you vote for the opposite candidate or withdraw decide to withdraw, pull out of the system or abstain, then you get someone who might reverse the partial that had been made.
I think you missed what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, what if the candidate that is running under the auspices of a political party that you would support, what if there's nothing that they're offering that you find important or that would drive you out to the polls? Like, it's not a matter of I didn't get everything I want. It's, well, there's nothing that I want here. So why then should I feel compelled to go and vote?
Well,
and also maybe just to bookend this, but
maybe I don't want to toot my own horn, but I do think that, you know, because I, as I mentioned, I wrote these articles in both November, or maybe it was October of 2016 and 2020, laying out my logic. People can look it up on Google if they want, on why I didn't vote for either candidate in those elections. And it was pretty easy to foresee why it is that I wouldn't want to endorse with a vote, to whatever extent that constitutes an endorsement, the subsequent foreign policy actions of the president who then took office. Like in 2016, you know, for one thing, Hillary Clinton was running around demanding a no-fly zone in Syria. I don't know if people recall that. And whereas Trump, you know, was way too much of a wild card that he seemed to have competing instincts about what sort of foreign policy he might pursue. He could also be easily captured by the, you know, Republican establishment. And, you know, I think that was borne out more or less under Trump. You know, he ended up actually escalating in Afghanistan in 2017. He bombed Syria twice. He did that whole Soleimani assassination. Yeah, he didn't start any full new ground or air wars, but that's sort of a low bar. And then in 2020, it was clear, you know, Biden pledged that he was going to continue basically the policy of the Trump administration on China, so basically escalating bellicosity to the point of a new Cold War scenario. And he's gone further than Trump on that score, you know, pledging to go to war with China over Taiwan just last month. He did do the Afghanistan withdrawal, which I think was foreseeable because of his advocacy against Obama's surge in Afghanistan in 2009 when he was vice president. But then he was also, along with the Democratic Party professional class, heavily radicalized against Russia. And I think that's informing some of the kind of the irrational policy now in Ukraine, which is all just to say, I mean, a lot of this stuff is actually pretty foreseeable. So I think, you know, withholding one's endorsement of that by way of a vote is perfectly tenable and can be well reasoned. So I guess I would just want to extract, if I could, an acknowledgement from you, Pierre, that maybe you did already say this in a sense, but you know, I think that your strategic voting logic, depending on what you prioritize, can result in a coherent case for why you're voting in the way that you are. But I think it might, I would hope that you could also likewise accept that a case for voting on different grounds, or not voting, that is, could also be coherent and tenable.
Right. Well, but even there, you started laying out differences between Biden and Trump and Obama.
Yeah, because I'm not saying there are no differences. I'm saying
there's no differences.
A bunch of bad stuff tends to happen under both Democratic and Republican administrations.
Well, I agree with that, but but the thing is that that's something you have to, I mean, I think that you have to assess your choices. And sometimes that does involve making hard choices. And that doesn't mean agreeing with either party, but if they're not the same, then you have to judge them and you have to make that assessment at the voting booth. And like I said, this is one part of how you participate in a democratic system, or at least what ideally should be a democratic system. That's only one part of it. There's activism. There's, you know.
Well, the beauty of our particular democratic system is that you can participate in the way that you see fit, and that can include declining to vote for X, Y, and Z reason.
That's true. Yeah. Well, yes, of course. You're not obligated, of course.
All right. Well, thanks, Pierre. Shall we proceed, Q? Q has left the building. Oh, there's Anthony. Okay.
Oh, sorry about that. No, I was saying that. Sorry about that. I was on mute. Anthony, you can go ahead.
Hey, hello. Thank you. The abortion activist, let's say. Well, I mean, I support it. I'm 100% for it. But they have a couple slogans that come to mind, and one of them is "My body, my choice." And I just, it's kind of hard to take that seriously after the last 2 years with the virus and that whole thing. And the other thing is abortion is healthcare. And it's like, okay, but what about health? Does that mean you could get all bankrupt for it and lose an arm and a leg in the process? Like, I don't get what that really means, because healthcare is money. So right. The whole thing isn't really making any sense.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is we don't have health care in this country. I don't have insurance
there
right
is,
now.
There is health care. It's just a matter of how the health care is administered and how, you know, who pays for it.
Well, so the question is who's we. I don't have health care. So I consider myself in a group of we who are uninsured.
No. So what I'm saying is health care does exist. The question is, how is health care funded? So America doesn't have universalized or public option for health care. Whereas I live in Canada where we do have.
Well, it exists, but I don't have it. It exists, but I don't have it.
Right. So the question isn't a matter of how is it paid for. The question is, do you have a right to undergo that procedure? And to my understanding, I mean, I haven't heard a compelling case against this as to why reproductive health does not concern the matter of the body under which we would normally file health care.
And the funny thing, Anthony, about the My Body, My Choice slogan is that it was appropriated in a somewhat trolling way by a lot of people who did not want to get vaccinated, as I'm sure you probably recall. And it was hard to understand what the counterargument was, because if anything, My Body, My Choice as a slogan for abortion, you know, skirts the issue of, we're not just talking about, quote, your body. The whole reason why this is a controversial subject is because there's another entity within the body that people debate the rights of and the obligations that the woman and society and God and whoever has to that, you know, fetus. Whereas in terms of to get vaccinated or not, My Body, My Choice is just purely a matter of your own bodily autonomy. Choice, right? So if anything, right. That slogan neatly apply to the vaccine question than the abortion question.
Well, here's what I wanted to introduce that sort of complicates that, because I've heard that one too. And the question is, okay, so if the state then, if the state enacted a policy because of a concern over falling birth rates, that that women are to be forcibly, like to be forcibly fertilized, then does that still become a question of whether the growing life within you has a right or has a say? So to me, it's a pretty terminal issue. The question is, does the host, that is the person within which the fetus is growing, do they get to have a determination as to whether their body is of continued use for the development of that fetus? And my answer to that is no, they don't.
I think if you're running around chanting the slogan "My Body, My Choice" and you support forced fertilization, then there might be some contradictions examine.
I'm not saying that I would support forced support.
Yeah, no, I get it.
I'm saying if you think that the fetus does have a right to life and is able to should have the ability to advocate for itself, or someone should be able to advocate on behalf of the fetus, then my question is, okay, under what circumstances? Because let's take this. I mean, I don't like to do the whole slippery slope thing, but the reason I get here in the first place is because people who I think engage in very counterproductive arguments will then ask the question, well, what about in the cases of rape or incest? To which I say, you dumbass, do you think that they're not going to follow through and just say, oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, we don't care about rape or incest either. So the question is, all right, well, let's take it one step further. What about forced fertilization? So so to me, it's like, well, if under all circumstances the woman must be forced to carry the fetus to term, then we should be able to pull back from that and say, well, who actually has the say here? And to me, it's the person that is actually growing the fetus within them.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm all for it. I just, the slogans, just, they seem hypocritical to me. That's all I had to make them.
I also think that, like, reducing these things to slogans is probably, to me, it's not mature. It doesn't make a convincing or compelling political argument. I'm not a fan of that either.
Yeah, I think this actually gets to why, just on a personal level, I admit I've always been a bit queasy about the subject of abortion, and I mean queasy in the sense of like determining my own moral convictions on the subject. I mean, for as long as I've been aware of it as a matter of public controversy, I found it difficult to reduce the whole constellation of thoughts and moral considerations that need to be taken into account to come to a view, I found it not like reducible to some firm moral conviction that could be translated into a slogan. And so I wonder if that sloganeering that tends to happen might have some effect on maybe alienating different groups of people who I guess reminiscent of me, maybe have some conflicted thoughts. I mean, in general, I'll say, you know, over the years, not that anyone necessarily cares, but I have, you know, if pressed, my default would be, look, I mean, I think abortion should probably just be legal within reason, because I can't say that I have a strong enough opinion pro or con to enforce my will upon others through the legal system. But beyond that, I also really can't just triumphantly declare to you what my resolute principles are on the subject. So anyway, just a little bit of a digression.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for the call. I think, Michael, do you want to give it till 6:30?
Yeah, whatever you want to do. We can go through the final three if you want.
Oh, yeah, okay, sure. If you're good to go all the way through, yeah. We can go ahead. All right, armchair, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think just to piggyback on the last point of discussion, before I make just one comment about the main subject we're discussing about today, I think that there's a very big difference between saying my body, my choice in the context of abortion and saying the same thing in the context of vaccines, because in the context of the abortion argument, at least, certainly the pro-abortion argument, it's a matter of at what point do you designate somebody to be a person, and a fetus who doesn't have reasoning abilities, can't communicate, or can't even feel any pain, and certainly is not self-conscious or even conscious of anything.
You really want to be careful of the whole, like, you know, consciousness and pain, because then you open yourself up to the conversation of, okay, well, when do we determine that? And until such time that we determine that, do we really know? And are we then subjecting a living being to suffering? You know what I mean?
I'm sorry. Can you say it again? I think you cut out for me.
No,
can you repeat?
I was saying that's one thing you really want to be careful of. And I tend to be a little bit crazy with that argument. Jesus Christ. Did I just use the word same word that Michael used? Anyway.
You did. You're pilfering my vocabulary.
For Christ's sake. Okay. So I tend to have a hard time with that reasoning. Because then you open up the question of, all right, well, when does the fetus begin to feel pain? When does the fetus experience consciousness? So on and so on. And do we really know this for sure? How closely can we trust the scientific studies that have already been conducted so far? And until such time we have a definitive answer, shouldn't we then conduct more research and hold everything off until then? And my answer to that is, it actually just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when the fetus is conscious, doesn't matter when it feels pain or any of that. Because the final question is, who gets to have the say here?
Yeah, and this actually gets to why it is that Roe versus Wade was ultimately overturned, because what the court did in 1973 was just decide that they had the judicial authority to delineate that for some reason it was constitutionally permissible for abortions to be committed up to a certain week of viability. You know, so how do nine justices in 1973 like have the station to come up with that determination? You know, it is, I mean, there is a certain arbitrariness to that decision that, you know, even over the years, a lot of liberal legal scholars have granted, you know, actually in the decision that was put out today, one of the very first people that Samuel Alito cites, and maybe this was a bit of artful trolling on his part, but in his footnotes, I think it's footnote number 3, he cites Lawrence Tribe, and sorry about the noise, but he cites Lawrence Tribe, who's this, you know, he's one of these resistance celebrities now, Harvard Law School professor. But in the early 70s, he wrote a journal article basically excoriating what he regarded as the, you know, faulty logic and reasoning of the original Roe versus Wade decision. So, yeah, I mean, this whole question of viability is a live issue, and it, you know, or at what point do you say that a fetus is viable? I mean, it's a hugely fraught question. So the idea of it just being decreed by some justices, it's reasonable to be wary about the prudence of that.
I'm not like a medical expert in this issue at all, but or any issue for that matter. But as far as I know, there is some level of consensus on when that pain threat, at least for the question of consciousness, which is the first thing, when the fetus can feel pain, and that starts around 20 weeks, and I believe that it has been taken into consideration by people who argue for the 24-week threshold in the Roe versus Wade decision. I understand there's another argument, obviously, that even if it doesn't matter, you know, who gets to decide, I think you can make that argument too. But I think that argument, I think it's actually much, much more problematic to make, because then you get into a whole stream of issues where, you know, if you do designate somebody a living being, then you have to take their personhood into account as well, and then, you know, it's much harder to make that argument. And I, being pro-choice, I think it's better to make the former argument, not that. But in any case,
the first point, on the first point you made, where you said, look, it's not the same to say that my body, my choice applies to choosing whether or not to get a vaccine versus choosing whether or not to get an abortion. And yeah, I mean, I would say, yeah, I would respond, yes, it is not the same. And I don't think anyone should assert that it's the same, but what it ultimately is in both cases is an appeal to bodily autonomy, right? So if your argument for why abortion should be permitted is a pure appeal to bodily autonomy, then it really isn't clear your enshrinement of the principle of bodily autonomy wouldn't apply to other scenarios. Does that make sense?
Sorry, you're really cutting out for me. Just give me one second.
Hold on. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I guess I'll just repeat. Although it's true that saying my body, my choice in reference to vaccines and saying my body, my choice in reference to abortion is not the same, there are different considerations associated with both those issues, but they are the quote same in the sense that both of those arguments are appeals to bodily autonomy, right? So if your argument for why abortion should be permissible is a pure appeal to bodily autonomy, meaning no one can tell me what I can do with my body, then it's not immediately clear, at least if you're going on the surface level sloganeering dimension of the argument, why that same bodily autonomy appeal shouldn't also apply to other questions of bodily autonomy, of which the vaccine question would be included.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think if you take the slogan and do not assume any other things about people who are making that, you know, who are uttering that statement, then yes, I think it might raise some questions about, you know, why we can't say that in one situation, not the other. But I think a lot of people, and that's why I sort of talked about, you know, at what point we decide who is a human being or rather a person who, you know, has those rights. It's because when you talk about my body, my choice, that you're assuming or presupposing that you're not hurting anybody by deciding to, you know, abort that fetus, as opposed to, you know, when you're talking about vaccines where you are hurting people if you get sick and you didn't get the vaccination, and then, you know, a bunch of people get sick because, you know, they're in the same room with you, and then they, you know, they go to the hospital and they die. So, but I see your point. I understand your point, the point that you're making, that like,
I mean, that's true. It's just that, but I mean, at the same time, it is ironic that for years, maybe decades, I don't know, for as long as I can remember, the main chant or slogan or mantra that was associated with the pro-abortion position was "My body, my choice," which, you know, just on a plain reading, is just a pure appeal to bodily autonomy. It's not like "my body, my choice," unless it may have the potential of harming others at some point. It's just that the principle of bodily autonomy is paramount. All right, shall we proceed, Q?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, guys. I cut out. Sorry, you guys cut out both of me. But I think it's my connection. So I think I'll just.
Let's continue.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot for the question, North. You can go ahead and unmute yourself. Microphone button, lower hand corner. There you go. Hey, you there? If you're speaking, I cannot hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's much better. Can hear you.
Okay, sorry, I got too many microphones. I kind of agree with what the last speaker was saying, but I kind of base my line off of different criteria. And I've been kind of batting around the line of about 20 weeks, 21 weeks that you could put personhood at. And I think that's what Roe v. Wade was kind of floating around anyways. And my physiological reason for that would be that there's never been a fetus that was either surgically, retrieved or born pre 21 weeks that survived. And the reason for that is that the lungs aren't developed enough to breathe air, and they are dependent on the woman's circulatory system to get oxygen. So, to my mind, that makes it logically follow that the fetus is a part of the woman pre 20 weeks, that they aren't two separate persons. And I mean, there might be some flaws to that, but I've been arguing with a few pro-lifers and I haven't been able to find the holes in it yet.
Yeah, you can go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think the physiological dimension of this is interesting, just even from a scientific perspective or a technical perspective. But I also think in a lot of cases it's a dead ringer, not a dead ringer, sorry, a red herring. I don't know why I said dead ringer. It's a red herring in terms of like what the actual salient issues are in the political debate around abortion. Like, I don't think the reason why it's such a contentious issue and why it begets such hardened views is like, you know, revolves around a technical consideration of what exact, when you can exactly pinpoint the point of viability using physiology, right? I mean, there's something broader at stake. And, you know, for religious conservatives, which is, you know, to be in fairness, the probably the driving force of how the Republican Party has come to the point now where they're able to field 5 or 6 justices to overturn Roe versus Wade. I mean, the religious argument doesn't really countenance much about this viability question, right? It's point of conception. And that's it. So it's more of a you can't really get to the underlying principle as to why there are such divergent views on this if you focus too much on that kind of narrow technical question around viability. I think that can often be a distraction, at least in terms of understanding what the stakes are and how people sort of orient their views on this subject.
Yeah, I think the pro-life side tries, definitely is coming at this from a religious point of view, but they try and hide that behind what sounds like scientifically based arguments. And a lot of the time, these quote unquote scientifically based arguments are about, you know, it's life, right? It's a life at this point. But that misses the point, right? Like, when is it a person? That's like, if you're going to call abortion murder, you have to define when it's a person.
I think that also misses the point too, and this is actually why I hate this conversation, and why I feel like it's very easy for like liberals and people on the left to get lost in the weeds. Is now we're getting into the question of when is the fetus viable and who has the right and so on and so on. And it's like, okay, so what is this for? Why have religious conservatives and conservatives generally been fighting against this since the 1980s? And the issue is that they have a specific policy agenda to make sure that birth rates remain high among people born in the United States, among native born Americans, and that they, in addition to keeping out immigrants, that they would have a higher native born population. And for various reasons, it's important to them that people who are making up the majority of new births in America are people who were Americans and their parents were Americans or grandparents were Americans. It comes into this idea that because we have people coming in from foreign countries, they're changing the makeup and character of the current country. And then the other question is, well, what does this mean next? What happens next after this decision? Well, Clarence Thomas very sneakily put it into his decision where he said, well, this also throws into the question as to whether same-sex marriages are also enshrined under the Constitution, whether that was a correct decision as well. So it's not a matter of, hey, how do we suss out this issue on its own and leave everything else, like leave the policy agenda in a vacuum? To me, it's, well, what is the ultimate policy agenda here and how do you fight that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think one thing that I have found annoying over the years, and not that I engage all that much in abortion debates, but I'm familiar enough with them that I'm familiar with the style of argumentation. What can be irritating is it often seems like religious conservatives don't have the courage of their convictions, because as North correctly alluded to, they really do often. I'm not saying all of them do this, and there are conservatives who you can debate the subject with who will, you know, grant this, but a lot of them do this kind of two-step where they'll say, oh, look, no, it's just a purely secular argument as to why I'm against abortion, and you don't need to accept any religious premises to support my perspective. And then you drill down, and it turns out they are, like, you know, committed theists and, you know, subscribe to a whole theological worldview around, you know, Catholicism or whatever it happens to be. And that really is like the ultimate motivation. And that's their starting premise, and they reason outward from there, right? Which is, you know, fair enough. It's not my worldview, but it's a understandable worldview. And yet they seem like they have to do this feint where they kind of couch their advocacy in non-religious terms, even though it's starting from a decisively religious perspective. And I think to the extent that there are extraneous religious infused reasons why they're pro-abortion that are separate from abortion as such, I don't know if it's about really birth rates so much as it is abortion being a proxy for the ability of society to engage in consequence-free sexual relations outside of marriage, potentially. And so if you remove the ability to obtain an abortion, you remove, at least ability of people to have consequence-free sex, which accords with their religious views as to what should be permitted.
I think that's probably what the Catholics and what evangelical Christians would say. But I don't actually even think that they believe it to the hilt. Like, I was raised in an evangelical church, and they would talk about abortion and the rights of the fetus all the time. And I also will say that there were many young women in the congregation who, when faced with the possibility of carrying a pregnancy to term or carrying out an abortion, quietly carried out the abortion, and people knew. So it's really, to me, like, I've seen a much stronger reaction from the people who would, like, write for, like, Techies Magazine and other such organizations, you know, John Bircher types, who have often talked about the question of birth rates and what that means for America's future, that white people are going to end up in the minority, which is wild to me because they'll still make up a plurality. But that fear, that phantom has been around since the late 1970s.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a strain of conservative thought which is not quite as distinctively Christian or religious in orientation. I think, you know, the John Birch people, although I'm, you know, they're Christians, probably by and large. Christianity is not kind of like the guiding impulse, but there are people for whom their Christian conservative convictions are the guiding impulse. And of course, there are always going to be hypocrites or people who don't match their words with actions and are fallen or whatever, to use that kind of nomenclature. But I think, you know, it's, I've spoken to and heard from enough Christian conservatives to know that there is a sizable segment of them who actually just do have this kind of overarching moral belief in how abortion is not just the unjust taking of a life, but also contributes to this wider degradation of society by imposing immoral sexual ethics.
So before I jump off, yeah, I agree with everything you guys said about the broader strategy and the complicatedness of it. But I think my main point is that the reason why, one of the reasons why we are now where Roe v. Wade has been overturned, is that these people with Catholic Christian motivations have been able to effectively be considered serious argumenters by, like you said, couching their argument in pseudoscientific statements. And I feel like we, the pro-life or pro-choice people, need to be just as clear about what science is and what abortion is doing. Because if we're not saying, hey, 90% of all abortions that occur are before 20 weeks and 65% of them occur in the first 8 weeks, you know, and there's never been a viable pregnancy before 20 weeks. Then you have the other side saying they are killing babies right up until the time of birth, and that a baby has a heartbeat at like 5 weeks or something crazy, when the heartbeat that they're talking about, any nurse or doctor will tell you, is not the same as like a 15-week heartbeat and stuff. So I think it's important to make clear statements about the physiology. Otherwise, you leave it open to interpretation, and that the right has taken that vagueness to their advantage and pushed a narrative into a way that has allowed the Supreme Court to make its decision.
Samuel Alito, who wrote the majority opinion on this decision, is a devoted Roman Catholic. And yet, nowhere in the decision is there any appeal to Catholic doctrine, and yet he subscribes to that doctrine, and how could it not affect his views on the permissibility of abortion? You know, it would have to, right? And so, but that's sort of a logical conundrum that doesn't seem to often be resolved among conservatives talking about this, at least in my experience.
Well, I guess the issue that I have there is that it assumes that, you know, Republicans and conservatives, even, you know, Christians, of example, Catholics, et cetera, that they're even having this conversation in good faith, that even if you, and I'm not saying it's not important to know these things, it absolutely is. Like, it is important to couch your, when I say couch it, like when you, the beliefs that you're basing it on, do have to have some, they do have to have a scientific fundamentalism to them. My issue, though, is that in making the argument, it assumes that the other side is operating in good faith, and that even if they hear you out, it's actually going to make a difference to them anyway. And in my experience, it never does. And the way that I know that is because, you know, how do they believe this in principle and in practice? And in the vast majority of my experience with evangelicals, of which I have, I would say, probably close to a 30-year history with them, the answer is no, they don't. They have very profound beliefs that they will talk about from the pulpit, that they'll preach to their personal lives, to their children, etc. But if faced with a question, the very difficult question, that there is an unwanted pregnancy in the family, will they see it all the way through? And I'll say that in many cases, the answer is no, they won't. So there's no reason to believe them. I think it really comes down to a matter of, you know, rather than trying to, like, you have to have a fundamental scientific understanding, yes. But is that where you should be arguing from? Or should you be arguing from the right simply exists and it's not open to debate. And starting from there, where can we begin to draft legislation? Let's start from that premise and work our way backwards.
Well, how about people whose, you know, I'm sure it's true that you've known a lot of evangelicals whose rhetoric does not match their actions and who are hypocritical, but I would think you would probably concede that there are some evangelicals and Catholics and such who are consistent. Would you be willing to grant good faith to them?
I'd be willing to grant good faith to some, but then my question is, well, why does their religious belief and their doctrines that they preach, what does it have to do with anybody else? So, I'm not a Christian. I'm Muslim now, you know, and there is an allowance for abortion up to a certain point. So why is it that a Christian person's belief regarding abortion should affect anything to do with myself or my faith? Why should an atheist have to abide by Christian doctrines? My question. So not only do I find that they argue in bad faith, they also don't really have a good reason as to why anybody else. Like, if you don't believe in abortion for your own community, then preach no abortions in your community. But anything outside of that is not your business, not your decision.
Well, don't a lot of Muslim majority countries, like in the Middle East, ban abortion? Abortion's banned in Saudi Arabia, right?
Oh yeah, sure, but that's the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which is a Wahhabist country.
Well, sure, but I mean, it's a form of Islam.
Well, sure, yeah, but it doesn't. The form of Wahhabism does not form anything remotely approaching Islamic faith. What it does is ascribe fundamentalist views that were made up by religious scholars in the late 1970s and 1980s. Their points of view, which are not supported in the Quran or in the Hadith, that's a fundamental point of view that they believe, and it's got nothing to do with anybody else. I'll give you an example of this. Another majority Muslim country is Bosnia, and Bosnia has access to abortion, and they also have near universal healthcare. So abortion is covered under their healthcare dictates, and you can get an abortion in Bosnia.
Well, I didn't know that. You want to continue?
No. I was saying that you can, like, Bosnia is a majority Muslim country, and you can get an abortion in Bosnia, so it kind of goes either way. It has nothing to do with this.
Oh, yeah, no, I may continue the next caller, sorry.
Oh, okay, yeah, sorry, go ahead. Jay, go free.
Hello, friends, can you guys hear me?
Oh, yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, my point was just going to be regarding, like, the political fallout or implications of this, but I live in... And Matthew Stoller today about the anti-abortion coalition, kind of a very group, like ranging from hardliners to are like, it makes me sad and I don't think people should get it. And that with the repeal of Roe, and then Jacob Bacharach, the radical blogosphere guy, had a tweet years ago that somebody said like they didn't even know what the Ian position on abortion in America would be. And his point was, it's the same as the median position on, you know, of Americans on everything, which is that on demand, probably for free, and not for. And so, you know, Stoller's point was like, well, now Republicans are in the position of actually having to, at the state level, legislate abortion. At which point, this anti-abortion coalition implodes because overwhelmingly, Americans don't want to actually make abortion illegal. Which in the state of Wisconsin, it's reverted to like some 1800s law where any abortion is a felony now. And that includes, you know, so if you have an ectopic pregnancy, if you have a molar pregnancy, if you're having a miscarriage, that's going to miscarry you as well.
Just curious, that law in Wisconsin didn't go into effect today, did it? Or is that just like...
Yes, it did?
So Wisconsin has a trigger law?
Well, not really, because it goes back to the law they had on the books regarding abortion before, which is from like the
1800s, I guess. Okay.
And Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin, called a special session of the Wisconsin State Assembly to be like, okay, well, we need to like up. I think in his case, he was saying at least protect the health care to say that you can have all these different types of pregnancy, they'll kill the mother. And the Republicans, in true fashion, just gaveled the session out like in 15 seconds and left.
Yeah. Right.
Which, you know, to me, one of the political repercussions of that is in Wisconsin, nothing. The state's so gerrymandered that it would take literal revolutionary action, I think, here. And I think the base of the Republican Party is hardline enough that they won't feel the need to change anything. But the thing is, as people get ectopic pregnancies, as people have molar pregnancies, as people have miscarriages that don't miscarry all the way, as people, like you said, have pregnancies that they don't want to keep,
like, yeah, we are,
of the law will start to add up. And not everyone
no, I think
can
that,
go to Minnesota or Illinois.
Yeah, I think that's plausible. Yeah, Wisconsin really is always like this 50-50 take no prisoners warfare, which is it's sort of interesting how that's always the case. I talked a little bit about what I speculated might be some potential repercussions of this earlier, but I think I did see that same Stoller thread, and I think he's got a point, which is that like the simplicity of the anti-abortion position now has been dissolved. In that, like, it almost doesn't make any sense anymore to just say, "Oh, I'm pro-life," because being quote pro-life can now take on, you know, a dozen different manifestations, and you know, you already have states like a bunch of states like Louisiana, Mississippi, what have you, have almost entirely outlawed abortion, and I saw that in Virginia, the Republican governor elected last year, Youngkin, is introducing a bill that I think would bar abortions after 12 weeks. So does that mean that if you're pro-life, you now have to oppose Youngkin? I mean, potentially. I mean, there could be a conceivable argument for that. But the point being that now, like, this the kind of moral simplicity that bound together the pro-life side, so to say, is almost necessarily going to disintegrate. And whereas I think there could very well be a hardening of that kind of uniformity on the pro-abortion side now. Because I, you know, it's funny because Roe versus Wade really was this like this unifying force that sort of arbitrarily bound together, arbitrarily accept the terms of what the abortion debate is. And now the abortion debate is going to have to be waged on entirely different terms. And we don't know how that's going to pan out. So I think Stoller could very well be correct in saying it's going to pan out in a way that redounds to the political disadvantage of Republicans. But I guess I'll just briefly restate what I said earlier, which is that I'm not so sure that it's obvious that the issue salience is high enough around this, that this issue is salient enough for the pro-abortion side that it's just going to obviously redound to the political benefit of Democrats either. I think it could in maybe certain House districts or something on a national level. I don't think it's obvious that this is an issue at the top of like the priority pyramid for a lot of in the way that a lot of activists seem to assume.
Most people don't care about it until it affects them, would be a good way to put it.
Yeah, which means it's not that politically salient of an issue, possibly.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Jay, really appreciate the comment. And listen, if I could. Oh, no, I just took Ryan's call. All right, you go ahead, Ryan. I was going to say, like, okay, so Ryan, you got to be the last caller because I definitely have to go. Michael, I'm not sure what your timing is looking
yeah,
like.
Yeah, let's wrap up with Ryan.
Yeah.
All right. I had a quick I was going to ask it. Actually, the last caller brought it up was in the case of miscarriages, which it looks like 10 to 15% of pregnancies end in miscarriage. Is that going to – I mean, where does that lead? Are we going to have an investigation every time there's a miscarriage and – was it the doctor's fault? Was it the mother's fault? Did the mother take drugs? Did the mother drink? Why did this happen? And is it going to tie up our courts in all these cases about trying to figure out why there's miscarriages? I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Well, I mean, I don't think any of these states are saying that it's now a criminal offense to have a miscarriage, right? They're not saying, like, my understanding is, and I haven't studied every individual law closely,
there already have been cases where women have had miscarriages and then were prosecuted.
Well, but they're prosecuted on the ground that I would assume, right, that the prosecutor is saying that they actually sought to have an abortion, and then they claim that falsely that they had a miscarriage, right? So the law that's being violated in that scenario would be the law against abortion, right? So it's not that miscarriage has been criminalized.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It hasn't primarily been for women who have sought abortion and then the procedure didn't take immediately. It's mostly been for women who have exposed the fetus to drugs. So if they've used drugs, and it can be shown that as a result of the drug use, like there's a line you can draw between drug use and the miscarriage, then on top of the drug prosecution, they have the manslaughter charge tacked onto it.
Oh, okay, I've heard of that. I mean, yeah. Look, I don't know how these new regimes, especially the most restrictive ones, like in the Deep South and what have you, are going to conduct themselves. I mean, it's just started today, so I think we should be humble about what we can foresee.
I think we can be somewhat confident in one trajectory, and that's that people who use drugs, people who live lifestyles that are deemed unhealthy or immoral and so on, they're going to be the first ones under the microscope, and everything past that is really a matter of speculations. But I mean, we already have some pretty good indications about who's going to be targeted under states that ban abortion and how. And it's rather unfortunate. Like, you know, there was the ability under the Obama presidency to codify abortion rights into law, and you know, they decided to hack that off from healthcare, treat them as two separate issues, and here we find ourselves today. But I want to thank. Yep. Sorry, go ahead, Michael.
No, I was just going to say. I was going to bid farewell.
Yeah, is there anything? I was going to ask if there's anything you want to plug before we go.
Oh, no, not really. I mean, you can follow me here on Colin if you want. I do a show usually twice a week or so, and yeah, that's about it.
All right, sounds
Twitter,
good.
Twitter, Substack, you know, the whole deal.
Yeah. Thank you so much for filling in for Glenn again. Appreciate your consistent willingness to pinch hit.
It's my solemn duty to cover up for his lies.
Not only cover up for his lies, but his for his sickliness. And you know, Glenn speaks a very big game, but unfortunately, he is a quite sickly man who is in the most fragile of health. So I appreciate you coming in to make up for his shortcomings.
Yeah, wow.
Malinger. All right, take care, Michael. And I'll, all right, thanks so much for your questions. Have a good weekend. Bye now.